Phony at the Camera, presenting American Classics on Saturday, February 19th at 7:30 p.m. at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The program features the works of Bernstein, Copland, Gershwin, and a new work written specifically for Sinfonia da Camera by composer Rudolf Hakken. Featured artists include violinist Rudolf Hakken, clarinetist J. David Harris, and pianist Ian Hobson. For more information, call 333-6280.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. Well, we certainly know that no matter how it is that you make your living, it can be very difficult to balance the demands of the job and of family. But it can be particularly difficult. There are some special kind of challenges for academic women, and we'll be talking about that this morning in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is a researcher who has looked at this question rather closely. Our guest is Dr. Mary Ann Mason. She is Dean of the Graduate Division of the University of California, Berkeley, and she's also co-director of a major research project called Do Babies Matter?, looking at the impact of family on the career paths of both academic women and men. She is joining us this morning by telephone, but next week, on Monday, she will be here on the U of I campus to take part in a symposium on graduate education. This is a free event, and it's for grad students and faculty and staff and alumni, all sponsored by the Graduate College. And as I say, it is free. However, they are asking that you register, and I'll give you the information a little bit later. You can call them. You can go online. There will be a number of speakers. It's a one-day program that's taking place on Monday, the 21st, at the Illini Union. And our guest this morning, Mary Ann Mason, is the keynote speaker. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. She has BA from Vassar College and PhD in American History from University of Rochester. She taught history at San Francisco State University and St. Mary's College, then received a law degree from University of San Francisco. She practiced law for several years. She founded and directed the largest paralegal program in the West at St. Mary's College. Then in 1989, she joined the faculty of the University of California, Berkeley. She's considered a national expert on child custody issues, having addressed many national and international conferences and workshops on children and family issues. She's been interviewed quite a lot on national media. In 2000, she was appointed Dean of the Graduate Division at UC Berkeley with responsibility for almost 10,000 graduate students and more than 100 graduate programs. And in addition to her duties as administrator, she also has been involved with this project that I mentioned, Do Babies Matter? She's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you are where we are, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So here, locally here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief, if they can, to help us keep the program moving. But, of course, calls, questions, comments are welcome. Dr. Mason, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure.
We certainly
talk to you.
Appreciate it. One thing we might want to mention just at the beginning that is certain, and it is a positive thing, like a lot of people feel it's a positive thing, that there are many more women in graduate school today than there were, say, 30 years ago. And this is something that's true across the country. There may be some disciplines where we might say women are a little underrepresented, but the main thing is true. If you look at women who are pursuing advanced degrees, many, many more today than when we were in college.
Well, that's certainly the case. Dramatic. It may be one of the most dramatic phenomena in American social history, the increase of women into not just higher education, but into professional and graduate education. When I became dean in 2000, for the first time, more than 50% of the graduate and professional students on this campus, Berkeley, were women. And in some of these professional schools, particularly in law, it's gone up from when I was in law school, perhaps 10% to 60%. In medicine, similarly, from 7% to 50%. And in most of the graduate fields, it has gone up as well. science and engineering are still low, but proportionate to what they were in the past, they have risen dramatically as well. So we really have achieved the feminization of graduate and professional education at the education level, and that's the stinger, because when you start going further than that, the picture starts to look very different.
Well, that is the next question and the next point to get to, is that on the one hand, we're saying there has been this very significant increase in the numbers of women pursuing advanced degrees. However, if you then take a look at faculty, just overall, and you can then go from that to talk about tenured faculty versus the people who are instructors and teachers and are on annual contracts and working part-time, things like that. But if you just even just look overall at all women faculty, they are underrepresented as a percentage of total faculty.
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, the gap between the proportion of people who have PhDs and those who are on a regular tenure-track faculty and receive tenure has probably not changed in the last 60 years. The numbers are different, but the proportion still remains the same. It's basically 2-to-1 that you graduate twice as many PhDs as are likely to have faculty positions compared with men. So the story, although it looks very different in terms of numbers, the same phenomenon occurs, that women become, they fall behind, usually in their 30s. And for most women, these are the make or break years. They must make their professional reputation with a tenure system, which is really focused on the first 5 to 10 years out of your degree, and it's also the fertility years between 30 or 40. So it's make and break in both ways. And for women, this is where women and men depart radically in terms of career paths. Women are far more likely to go into the second tier in the university world, which is largely the part-time adjunct world, fastest growing part of academia, because in fact, last year I think the AAUP found that more than half of undergraduate courses are now taught by part-time or adjuncts. And this is, again, disproportionately women. So that's been one of the unexpected but I think unfortunate consequences of the feminization of graduate education, that the second tier has grown so rapidly. And it's largely an exploited and not a great place to spend your career, because there's very little security and very little career advancement possible.
Yeah. Well, if you take a look at the explanations that have been offered, when you ask this question, okay, why is it that we have women are underrepresented among the ranks of tenured professors, and that they tend to be overrepresented in these areas where you have people who are part-time, the adjuncts, the visiting lecturers, the people who are working from 1 year to the next and might not know if at this point, you know, are they going to have a job next year? The one conventional explanation is something like, women simply, all through their schooling, aren't encouraged to pursue advanced degrees, to pursue academic careers, or once they get into the academic world, they hit the glass ceiling. There's just not a willingness to promote them. That's as may be, but I think what you have focused on is a different sort of an issue, and one that perhaps hasn't gotten quite as much attention, and that is the fact that women often are presented with a choice. Do you pursue an academic career? Do you pursue tenure? Do you have a family? And can you do both of these things? And it appears that the answer is no, you really can't, and that women are forced to make a choice.
Well, the problem is the choices are limited. But to get back to your first observation, there have been these two schools. Basically, it's the discrimination issue. I call it the 1,000 paper cut school, which where women are disadvantaged sometimes from a very early age and discouraged from taking math, or in various ways rooted along the way differently. And then as they advance through the system, again, paid less attention to, paid less, et cetera. And Larry Summers, who evoked, I think, an extreme end of that when talking about the aptitude of women for science, you know, really expressed one part of that school, which says women just can't do it well enough, and therefore we're not going to take them seriously. The other argument, and these are overlapping, obviously, these are not two entirely different arguments, is that women, for the most part, the doors have opened up for women in most fields, but what is constraining women more than 1,000 paper cuts or discrimination is the effect of family formation. The doors have opened at the educational level, but the structure of the workplace has not changed. I think by all accounts, it's more difficult to get tenure today than it was 30 years ago. The expectations have gone up, partly because the numbers of PhDs have gone up as well, and the pressure is greater. But and it's certainly true because I also study women lawyers and doctors and MBAs, that in terms of law practice and business and medicine, the number of hours have increased also over the last 30 years. So we've opened the door to women at the same time that the system has actually revved up and demanded more in terms of hours. And then women are expected to more or less have a family on the side. There's been no really collective will to significantly change the structure of the workplace to allow women to drop out for a period of time, perhaps, or reduce their hours, and then return. They can drop out, but they just never are allowed to return. It's a one-way drop out of the pipeline.
Well, in this, I think there's probably an important point to be made here that people might not understand if they're not part of the academic world. It is certainly difficult. Women, no matter what their career path, they have a tough time managing the competing demands of family and job. And in the professions, as you say, medicine, law, that's there too. But one thing that makes the academic world different is that if you decide that you want to pursue tenure, you have a rather limited window.
Yes.
And if you don't get it at that time,
right,
it's very unlikely that you're going to be able to get it at all.
That's right. For most people, men and women, it's one chance. It's up or out. And if you aren't chosen, you may get another position somewhere, but it probably won't be what you were looking for, and you're more likely to fall into a second tier or just change professions entirely. So there's an enormous amount of pressure on just that time frame, which for most men and women, the average person at the University of California system becomes an assistant professor at age 33, and they receive tenure then 6 years later or so. So you're talking about really bumping on to 40 before you get tenure. And a lot of women particularly will defer childbearing until after that, and deferral often means denial because it becomes too late in the clock. So overall, the women who do pursue an academic career to tenure are far less likely to have children.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour. We have a caller we'll get right to in just a moment. Dr. Mary Ann Mason is Dean of the Graduate Division of the University of California, Berkeley. She is considered a national expert on child custody issues. She is also co-director of a major research project looking at the impact of family on the career paths of academic women and men. Do Babies Matter? That's what it's called. And she also will be here on the U of I campus on Monday to take part in a symposium on graduate education, defining academic success. She is the keynote speaker, and we'll be talking about some of these very issues. This is, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, a free event for grad students and faculty and staff and alumni of the university, sponsored by the Graduate College. And they are just asking that you register if you want to attend this. This will be Monday, February 21st, in the Illini Union. And you can register either by calling them at 333-0035 or going to the website, the grad website, which is www.grad.uiuc.edu. Here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller listening over in Indiana this morning, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly happy you have this lady on, David. From my own history, it's good to see somebody, a woman ahead of the dean of the graduate school, for sure.
Thank you.
Anecdotally, quite some time ago, my wife and I were seniors, and my wife was a sociology major, and beginning of the second semester of her senior year, she wrote a paper for a professor, and he came back full bore. He says, we'll tighten this up, and you're going to be in the American Journal of Sociology. And she was, quite excited. She's a very intelligent woman. And my minor was sociology, and I read the paper, and it was damn good. There's no question about that. Then we both decided we had to go to the same graduate school, of course, so we started applications. And basically, we decided we'd just stay where we were because we thought, sure, that she was a shoe-in for a nice fellowship for graduate school. And she was turned down, which I remember it upset a lot of the younger sociology professors who were just assistants, were just starting out. Some of them had just gotten their PhD and were starting out, actually. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, since we're more liberal, but she was told finally, because I pushed it, I wanted to find out what the hell was going on. She was told that, well, you're married, you're going to have a child, there's no sense in wasting money on you. That, in a slight sense, helped our divorce, because she became a feminist from that moment on and looked at men in a rather askance way, and I unfortunately fulfilled that view in some ways, but that's another question.
No, but how long ago was that?
Oh, this was 4 years ago. I'm retired. This is back in the early 60s when things started happening.
Well, then, in those days, they would have said that overtly, without doubt.
Oh, yeah. Now
they won't, but it doesn't mean that the same kinds of things don't go on, particularly, I think, in the sciences.
I realize that. And just a footnote to that science thing, I was a math minor because I was a philosophy major, and I come across some girls that, you know, who, you know, pin me to the wall. So I don't buy all that stuff being shown. But the thing I was interested in, and this may be out of date, because I remember when we graduated in philosophy, one of my buddies became an insurance agent. And I just started, you know, I thought, that's sort of strange, you know. But, you know, I was pretty idealistic, and, you know, and didn't realize, you know, since the supply-demand thing.
Yes.
Now, the supply-demand thing now is really getting small. And, you know, everything I hear about the University of Illinois on the news is that, you know, they're lucky to still be there, in a sense, that monies are being cut down. This over 50% of women in the graduate school, if they can't go into their, you know, like I said, along the analogy of this guy, a philosophy major, turning into insurance, what do they do with their degrees? Is there this is a broad casting of things, but is there a particular areas that they, if they can't use their degree in math, really, or degree in whatever, you know, even if it's phys ed, as far as that goes, is there areas they go to, or do they do like, it happened in my period, you just take a step downward and end up being sort of I don't know, you have a degree and, you know, maybe get you 50 cents more an hour or something like that. I was wondering if that was going on. Thanks a lot, and keep up the good work.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I think there's, at least in my experience, there have always been areas where the supply has been greater than the demand, and that's always very difficult. If you're in an area of math or science these days, or biology, there usually are industrial jobs that both men and women take, and sometimes they pay much better than the university. In terms of the math major, or the French major, or whatever, the French major or the English literature major who doesn't get a job, what usually happens, and this is something you didn't actually say, but it's the dual career couple issue, which is much more common for academics. Academic women are much more likely to marry academic men than the other way around. So that usually the couple will go to where one job is. And more often than not, it's the man's job, although that isn't necessarily the case. And that really puts women at disadvantage as well, because they're forced to go to a place, for instance, like Champaign Urbana, which maybe only has one major university, and there wouldn't be more than two jobs in French literature. So a number of things that go on in that regard. Women are somewhat more likely than men to take the part-time track if they don't get regular jobs. So that is where women more often go. And they do this partly when they have children, and they do it sometimes because they don't have jobs. But at UC, the people in the pool, as many single women as single men are part of the pool, but it's the women with children and married women who don't even apply for the job. So they're actually leaking out of the pipeline before getting their first job. That's the major leak.
We have other callers. Let's bring them into the conversation. We'll go next to Crete, and that's line number one. Hello.
The first question has to do with her history background. I take it you studied under Christopher Lash at Rochester.
I'm sorry, I can't quite hear you.
I guess you studied under Christopher Lash at Rochester.
Well, yes. He actually came a little bit after I left, but I certainly know his work.
The second question is an academic question, Dean. Say the administration is looking for another administrator, which they often do, and he has a Ph.D. in Indian history or whatever strange field it might be. And they finally come to the history department, really after they almost hire the guy, and say he's going to have tenure and be a full professor in your department. Joy to the world. Now, the history department has just found out about this, and they're not too happy with his credentials, you know, Southern Eastern State University, Ph.D., etc. What would you do under the circumstances in, one, the administration says yay to for this guy because he looks like a good administrator. We don't give a damn about his history background. And two, the history department says, good God, he's being foisted upon us like a rotten apple. We protest strongly. What would you do, Dean?
Well, at UC, it wouldn't happen that way because the faculty have to agree. And very rarely are they asked to do anything like that. And if they are, it would have to be someone they would believe that was capable of or meets the same qualifications as all the rest of the professors. So that's really an internal issue that you have at that particular university. So I really can't comment on that.
Okay, as far as the women in history, is that a significant change in the last 10 or 15 years in the history department?
Well, again, it's one of those fields where the percentage of women, because again, I have a PhD in history, and I think there were only maybe 15% at most, perhaps 12%. So the percentage of women is much higher now. It's more like 50%. But still, it's not 50% in the hiring pool, so that probably only 25% of the new hires will be women across the board. Now, that may not be true in every single department. So there's still the 2-to-1 gap between those who get their PhDs and those who get tenure. And the major leak, as I say, is women themselves who, either because of dual career or because they have a baby, they decide not to go for that job, and once they wait too long, there's usually not an opportunity to recapture that moment of getting your first hire. And it's also true that women leak out of the pipeline and don't get tenure at a rate higher than men. But that's probably less a family issue than other kinds of things that go on in terms of some of the gender discrimination.
Is that change that's taking place mean that there'll be less courses on the history of the Civil War and more courses on social history?
Well, I think in general, I mean, my experience with history departments is that they have changed to some extent over the years and have tried to respond to growing areas of scholarship, which tend to be more global and more perhaps a little different than the traditional, but the traditional courses are still taught as well.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Champaign for the next call. This is line number 2. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Could you briefly discuss the issue of child care and the availability of adequate child care, and whether how much this exacerbates the situation for women in academia?
Well, there's no question that child care is really the elephant in the kitchen for all working women, and certainly for professional women in academia as well. You know, as I've told you, I've also studied women in other fast-track professions, and women who are in these fast tracks, law, medicine, academia, they all work a lot. They work usually 50-plus hours a week, because they can't really succeed without that. So in order to work 50-plus hours a week, you have to have really good support at home. And most of the women who I've interviewed, because I've been writing a book on this as well as the researcher, they attribute a large part of their success to having a partner who is very supportive. But their partner may also be a professor or a lawyer. So they all have to depend to some extent on other kinds of child care, either child care centers, or if you have, as lawyers and doctors often do, more expendable income, the at-home, in-home child care. Academics generally don't have that income level, so in some ways they are more, I think, at risk in terms of not having appropriate child care arrangements. And any working mother will tell you that it really only takes, a sick child, and it just throws you totally out of the loop, unless you have a really good support system in place, which is very hard to manage. And it's not just the, as I say, the outside child care. Usually you have to have some help at home as well, because your children can't always be taken to daycare.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Dr. Mary Ann Mason. She is Dean of the Graduate Division of the University of California, Berkeley, and as we've mentioned, also has been involved in this major research project, Do Babies Matter?, taking a look at the impact of family on the career paths of academic women and men. She is the keynote speaker at a symposium on graduate education that will take place on this campus, U of I campus, on Monday, February 21st. It's free, and it's for grad students and faculty, staff, alumni. It's sponsored by the Graduate College. The only thing they ask is that if you want to attend, you register, and you may do that either by calling 333-0035 or go to their website, which is www.grad.uiuc.edu. edu. And here on this program, questions welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I wonder if you have some feeling that over time, young women who are in graduate school, do they know what they're getting into if they're aiming for an academic career and want to go after a tenured position?
Well, really, that's why we started this research project, because I think there's an enormous amount of questions and concerns that young women have about really what are the possibilities, what are the barriers, what can they expect, can they have it all, can they do it? As a result of this research project, actually we've implemented a number of changes here at the UC system to make it more family friendly, to stop the clock, to allow 2 semesters for childbirth, to put in place a flexible part-time track. We have a number of initiatives which is really aimed at changing the structure of the workplace, but even more than that, changing the culture to be more accepting of parental roles. Because if universities don't take the lead, how else is it going to happen? We're supposed to be the enlightened part of society and being able to see how to make things progressively better. So we've been very active in the implementation part here as well. It's a long road, though, because no institution is easy to change or necessarily willing to change.
Mm-hmm. We have been talking about the lives of academic women and the challenges that they face in trying to manage their careers and have families as well, and particularly the difficulty that right at the time that you would be working on trying to secure tenure might be, for a lot of women, the time that they would want to be thinking about starting their family, and just how difficult that can be. I mentioned a couple of times that your research doesn't just look at the impact of family on the career paths of women, also at men. And I'm wondering, well, are the men getting a free ride here?
Well, the research we're talking about largely here is the survey of doctor recipients, which has been sponsored by NSF and NEH since the 1960s, and it's the best employment database, longitudinal. Everybody who gets a PhD fills out the survey once, and then 4% are tracked every 2 years as a cohort of 4%. So 160,000 people are in this database. You really get a very good sense across the fields, and you can answer these questions more accurately than you can just, you know, anecdotally or looking at your own university. Overall, men with children are the most successful of the academics. They're more successful than men without children, than single women, and far more successful than women with children. So I don't say they're getting a free ride, but their demographic patterns are different. For instance, of full professors, the percentage of men with children who have full-time working wives is only, I think, something like 57%, and it's 98% for women with children who have a husband. Men are far more likely to have wives who are not working full time, and women are not. So this is partly a function of demographic choices.
It's really interesting when you look at these things and you see things like the fact that it's more likely that tenured women are more likely to be single than tenured men, and the women, academic women, it's more likely that their partner will also be an academic than the other way around. So there are all these really interesting and significant differences. I want to come back though to the finding that academic men with children do better than either single academic women or the academic women who get
explanation.
Why?
Well, I always think about what my dear father, who's long passed away, used to say. He said, "Marriage really straightens up a guy, and having kids makes him very stiff." It's the motivation factor, he would say, and perhaps there is some truth to that. That men with children are motivated in a way that makes them perhaps more productive than men without children. I'm not sure. I think our data doesn't really tell us why; it just tells us what is.
When you actually ask women about their experiences, and you know, we've talked about the fact that it may be that the constraints of family make it difficult for women to secure tenured positions, or at least to get going down that road. And for that reason, perhaps now that's why it is that women are overrepresented in the non-tenured positions,
the second tier.
And this is people who are are teaching also are doing research. The people who are the adjuncts, the part-timers, the people who are on just working from one year to the next on
yes.
annual contracts, who don't have the kind of job security that comes with the tenure. I wonder, when you have the opportunity to the extent that you've done this, ask women about their experiences, are there in fact women who say that the obligations of family or the fact that they had to make this choice actually led them out of academia completely?
Yes. Oh, yes, of course. There are many women who would say that. Or there are some women who actually do not work at all, but that's a very tiny percent. Of the women who are going through professional school or through a PhD program, they're generally going to be back in the workforce in some capacity or another, but as you say, it may be entirely outside. But again, women with children are more likely to be those who do stay on the fringes of academia in various ways, partly because they're often married to academics. And the part about those jobs, because I think all mothers would like to have a period of time, certainly when their children are very small, when they didn't have a full load, so they're very attractive in that regard. But the part about these jobs are that there's no way to re-enter, and they become very marginalized. Women who are teaching part-time or adjunct often are really not even recognized by name by others in their department.
Well, you touched on some of the things that have happened there at your school, and that also that you recommend perhaps other places that they look at in terms of employment practices that are more family friendly. And it seemed like that one of the major things you talk about, and we talked a little earlier about the thing that makes the academic career different than others, is that you have a small window for when you're up for tenure, and if you don't get it, chances are you don't get it.
Yes.
One of the things you're talking about is slowing down the process or giving an opportunity for people to put that process on hold so they don't face this up and out situation.
Right. I mean, there are two things you can do. One thing you can do is basically discount the resume gap so that women who choose following receiving a PhD or while they're graduate students to have a family can then perhaps 5 or 7 years later begin the process. Because those of us who are mothers, I think all agree that the really intense years are the first 2 or 3, and then be allowed to do it on a regular basis. That doesn't happen because, particularly in the sciences, but across the board, if you haven't published or had done anything active professionally for 5 to 7 years, your resume doesn't get looked at all. Another model would be just immediately starting out on the tenure track with children or without children and having a child during that period, which is when you pretty much need to in order to maintain your fertility options, and being allowed to stop out for a year or two during that period. And we do that to some extent with stopping the clock up to 2 years and a year out for childbirth. We're trying to elongate that so that you can perhaps even go for 2 or 3 years on a part-time basis, giving different kinds of options for parents with children, and all, it will be largely women, but it really be for men as well if it's appropriate. If they are the primary caretaker, because it is, again, unique in academia to have this one, usually 6 to 7 year period of time on which everything hangs, and to, in some ways, mitigate that particular time bind would really open it up a lot for women. They would feel much more welcome, feel much more willing to pursue a long-term academic career, and the university would be much more willing to take women with children as well. So it would work in all ways. If it could be, the university is also a very conservative institution, and it's hard to change it. So that is really the goal, and we are, inching away at it at all universities, and we've made some great progress here at UC.
Yeah. You mentioned a little bit earlier the statistical fact that academic women, it is more likely that their partners would also be academics than
yes.
than the other way around, which gets us into the very difficult situation that often two couples face if they both are essentially make their living in the same industry, and that it happens over and over again. And I'm sure people listening to us will know about situations like this. Anybody who's in the academic life knows places where you do have these kind of couples. And if there's a move, it is pretty likely it's going to be they're moving for the man, not for the woman. And then you end up with university communities where you have a lot of very highly educated women who are underemployed.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's is there anything that universities can do about that?
Well, universities have traditionally just made use of the fact that they had all these really well-educated, underemployed women, and that is really part of the reason we have this second tier that is so robust. I think that there could be some concerted effort to make use of these very talented people in a more centralized way and not marginalize them, to consider them for faculty positions, which generally doesn't happen. But the two career problem is a real problem for academia. There's no way around it. It also becomes an issue. We've surveyed our UC faculty here later on, because the way in which many professors get higher salaries, to be honest, or advance up the career ladder is by moving, or at least getting other offers so that the university has to match their offer to retain them. And women don't play that game, at least in terms of our research on this. Women with children do not play that game because they don't believe that they can leave when their children are in school or small. Men do not see it as such a barrier. So there's also that's something of a cultural difference between men and women. Women's unlikely or refusal to consider outside offers, and men playing the game that way. So as you go further up the line, when women do become professors, often their salaries are lower than men because they haven't really taken the same kind of, they haven't played the same game in terms of courting outside favors. And then again, moving up to higher administration, until last spring I was the only woman dean at Berkeley, and there are 20 deans. There are a number of cumulative factors that men usually in a better position for the higher administrative jobs, which usually come later on when you've had some basic experience as chair and other kinds of administrative experience. So there's a cumulative effect for women, too. So they might get tenure, but even after that, becoming a full professor, becoming part of the higher administration, at every step of the way, there are family considerations and a cumulative effect of not having moved as quickly up the ladder as men.
Yeah. I just have to go back to something that you said. I want to make sure I heard this right. Until last spring, you were the only woman dean at UC Berkeley?
Yes, yes. It's true. For the first few years I was here.
Is that
staggering?
Well, yes, actually, yes. It does strike me that way.
Yeah. Well, that's a little unusual, but usually it's not more than 25% or 10% or something like that. Yeah. Really, it depends. I mean, we all look around us and we only see our own little pond, so we take that to be the universe. But I don't think it's that unusual. Overall, there are still relatively few high-level women academic administrators.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, I'd like to introduce our guest, Dr. Marianne Mason. She is Dean of the Graduate Division of the University of California, Berkeley. She is considered a national expert on the subject of child custody and has done a lot of speaking and done many interviews on that subject. She's also authored some books on that subject and is also the co-director of this research project we've talked about, looking at the impact of family on the career paths of academic women and men. And she will be here speaking at a conference the beginning of next week. And I'll try one more time to mention the details on that before we finish up this part of the show. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Is there something else that you're also suggesting that universities could do to try to make life perhaps a little bit easier for this large number of women who are in the second tier, the non-tenure track, the adjuncts, the lecturers, the people who don't have the job security that comes with tenure?
Well, it's interesting because I think there is a major effort for this second tier to become unionized. And that's a kind of a basic protection for basic benefits and security, and I think that might be useful. But what they are not getting is participatory rights in the university. That means they also get some recognition for publication. They'd be put on a regular track and perhaps receive the opportunity to go to conferences or sabbaticals, and to be considered ultimately to go back on a regular full-time tenure track. There's just a whole huge split between the two worlds, the second-tier world and the first-tier world, and very little participation or overlap is allowed currently. And that would be one of the ways, because, as I say, there's a disproportionate number, as you said, at your university and ours as well, of incredibly accomplished, talented women with PhDs who are here because their husband's teaching on the faculty, and they really don't have an opportunity to participate as a scholar for which they were trained.
What do you? One of the things that you point out in the report, and this perhaps gets a little bit away from the experiences of women who are doing teaching or research, but it is also the case that universities depend very heavily on women doing other kinds of jobs, particularly women who are clerical. And if we did not have those women, the university would grind to a halt. No question about it. This is something that you speak to a little bit.
Yes.
Does the idea of making the place more family-friendly touch them, too?
Well, that's such a good point. Actually, I've written a lot about women. I call them women who work to live as opposed to women who live to work. The women who are in the workplace now, and a large percentage of them are mothers, probably a higher percentage than among the faculty, and they are in the workplace because in America there is no longer the family breadwinner wage, and they must work. There's really no choice for them. And I have a large staff here in graduate division, and I have any number of mothers on my staff. And thank you for bringing it up, because it is certainly part of what a university must do, I think, to be a citizen of the world and to set the example in terms of family-friendly policy, to look to what's going on with the staff. The first Christmas I was here as an administrator, as the dean, I have this large staff, and I actually didn't realize that the staff did not actually get a week off for Christmas vacation. They had to take their family vacation or comp time in order to get the time off. Because as an academic, of course, you get a lot of breaks, the same breaks the students get. So it's a whole different world. And then I realized that even though academic women have a lot of difficulties and a lot of pressure, the staff here have a different kind, and a very serious kind, and they haven't really been addressed much in terms of the general university policies. So more flexible career paths for working mothers on the staff is another very important issue. It's a little different than the academic women because they're not in the tenure track up or out. It's a different kind of problem, but is just as serious a problem on any university.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a sort of a secondary issue, but I'm interested in your thoughts about it. We here at this university have in recent years been experiencing some really severe financial pressures, and it's happened, I'm sure it's happened there. It happens everywhere because state budgets have been very tight, and that means that the money going to education in those states has been reduced, and universities all over have to look at everything they do and ask this question, okay, how can we continue to try to do the same thing, provide quality education, and do it for less? And I think that what's has certainly happened over the last, maybe even going back before things got really bad in about 2001, is that universities more and more are relying on part-time staff, or again, these kind of people that we've talked about, that they don't really have a lot of job security. They're on annual contracts. There may be some deal that says, okay, if we're going to fire you, we got to give you a year's notice, but it's different than having tenure. And I guess I wonder what you think about the future of tenure, and do you think that over time that we'll continue to see a reduction in the number of tenured professors at the average university?
Well, that's a very good question. Basically, what you're seeing is universities moving increasingly toward a corporate model. Mm-hmm. And you could call the part-time and tenure, particularly those who are teaching the classes, a kind of outsourcing in the sense that that is the corporate model. You do it as cheaply as you can with whatever labor you can find. And because of the feminization of graduate education, there is a labor pool there that wasn't necessarily there before. So we're allowing the university to develop into much more of a corporate model. That's actually happening in other fields like law and medicine, where there is a large pool now of women who are available and, for various circumstances, usually family, willing to work at a reduced model. So it's happening with law. It's happening with the university world. I think this is something that is truly a serious issue in terms of what we expect a university to be. The core of tenure was to preserve an independent group of scholars who could think and speak freely and not be basically part of a corporate structure where they would be fired or, for whatever reason, treated as employees, but given a sort of independence. And I think that is really what's made the university great. Certainly I can see this at research universities like Berkeley and University of Illinois, that the researchers are great researchers because they are independent. They're allowed to pursue subjects that they want to pursue and to really take initiative, which would not be the case if you were part of a corporate structure. You'd be worried about the bottom line for the university, and there would be all kinds of other concerns. So I sincerely hope that the trend doesn't become stronger than it is, but it certainly is a trend, and it's hard to resist, as you say, particularly at universities that do have to look at the bottom line and feel that they are no longer able to offer tenure as generously as they have in the past. I think there will be a reduction in the number of professors who are on a tenure track, and I think that's not a good trend. I don't think it will disappear, certainly not within the near future, because it is really what makes a university in terms of being able to have independent researchers and ideas.
Yeah, it certainly is something that I know there is a great deal of concern among faculty people,
yes,
among the professors, and I would expect that the administrations would be sympathetic, since that's where the administrators come from, but that on the same time they're coming up against their boards and their trustees and, you know, the people who are on that end of thing making policy that seem to be leading the charge in that way. And I wonder, faculty has certainly talked about this. They've raised their voices. They've said, look, we think that there's something going on here that has the potential, at least, to affect adversely the character of higher education. And we don't think that that's a good thing. And on the other hand, you have, it seems that the governing bodies are there. They're looking at the bottom line.
Yes.
They're ultimately the ones that have the power. And I guess I really wonder how that works out. Between the, you know, who ends up having the strongest hand here, and I sort of feel that probably it's not the faculty.
Well, you're right, it's not the faculty. Although, again, for a university to have a top reputation, they really have to be able to attract the top researchers and minds in that field. And they're not going to get them without a tenure system. It just might become smaller. There'll be fewer people who are on the tenure track and more of the kind of outsourcing model to the part-times and adjuncts. And as I say, that's part of the unintended consequence of the feminization of graduate education. And I think it really is up to the people who are involved, which includes the part-time and adjuncts, to join forces with the faculty and to really try to stop this, as you say, very relentless move, which is based on economics. Because I don't think we want to have University of Illinois looking like a McDonald's corporate structure. And that is the direction it's moving in. I really do fear that.
Well, there, at about that point, we're going to have to wrap up. This very large subject, that is the feminization of graduate education, is the topic of a talk that our guest, Mary Ann Mason, will be giving here on the U of I campus next week. And I just want to mention one more time that she will be the keynote speaker at a symposium on graduate education. This is a free event. It's sponsored by the Graduate College here at the U of I, Urbana-Champaign, and for graduate students, faculty, staff, alumni. It is free. It's taking place on Monday, February 21st, in the afternoon. And that's her talk will be at 1 o'clock. And again, anybody who is interested, you know, here on the campus should certainly feel welcome. The only thing is that they ask that you just do register. You can call 333-0035. Or go to their website. That may well be the easiest thing to do, www.grad.uiuc.edu. Our guest, Dr. Mary Ann Mason, is Dean of the Graduate Division of the University of California at Berkeley. And Dr. Mason, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you. I very much enjoyed it. I look forward to coming to your city soon.
All right.
Next week.
Next week. Very good.
Bye.
Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. A reminder before we finish up this morning that tomorrow we will welcome back to the program two guests that certainly you have heard before on the show. And our number one, the guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician and for a long time, actually many, many years, has been stopping by on the program on a regular basis, always on a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour to talk about children's health. We thought that it would always be something that listeners would have questions about. And if you have questions about your kids or the children in your life, you can call in and talk about that with him. We've talked about a lot of the basic things, dealing with bumps and bruises and sports injuries and sleep problems and vaccinations and illness and wellness and all that sort of stuff. Anything you can imagine talking about with a pediatrician, you can do that tomorrow morning with Dr. Bocek in the 10 o'clock hour. And then in our number two, the 11 o'clock, we welcome back to the program Mae Barenbaum. She is an entomologist, a scientist who studies insects. She is, in fact, the head of the entomology department here at the U of I, and we'll be talking a little bit about the upcoming Insect Fear Film Festival, now a world-famous event, the 22nd annual, and the subject is going to be forensic entomology. So we'll be talking a little bit about that, about how it is that insects end up being used as a tool to solve crimes. And then, of course, other insect questions you have, you can ask them. That's tomorrow. And we'll talk about the festivals as well with May in the second hour tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. That's 10 different shows a week. We always welcome your questions and comments and invite you to call in. Right now, though, we want you to stick around because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. And at noon today, we're going to have a live coverage of the governor's budget address. Here's Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. That's correct. Coming up this afternoon at noon, the governor presents his budget proposal for the coming fiscal year to a joint session of the Illinois General Assembly. So we will join Illinois Public Radio in Springfield for live coverage of the governor's budget message. Let's turn our attention now to what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. March wheat trading at 292 and three quarters, down 6.5. May 299 and three quarters, down 7. March corn 197 and a quarter, down 2.75. May 204 and a half, down 3. July 211.5, down 3. December 228.5, down 2.5. March beans 529.5, down 5.75. May 529.75, down 5.75. November, 543, down 4.75. March meal, 161.20, that down 190. March oil, 1948, down 14. March feeder cattle, $100.35, that up 10 cents. February live cattle, 90.15, down a nickel. April lean hog, 74.22.5, up 122.5. And February bellies, 87.10, up 10. May Brent crude 45.27, down 31. The CRB 287.25, down 208. The U.S. dollar 83.96, up 42. And the Dow is down 31 points at 10,806. The S&P 500 down 3 points at 1207. You're tuned to AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 1 minute before noon Central Time, 37 degrees in Urbana. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: in the far north, intervals of clouds and sunshine with some flurries. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny, highs ranging from 32 in the far north to near 50 in far north.